Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Yeah, very welcome back to Off the Ball on this Sunday. Will O'Callaghan sitting in for Joe Molloy. It is time for us to have a look at the papers from today. We are joined by Dan McDonald and also by Kieran Cunningham. Good afternoon to you, lads.
Afternoon.
Hi, Will.
Dan, what do you make of our Sunday offerings? Before we start to dig into the detail on this, what's caught your eye in the Sunday papers?
It's slim enough pickings today, to be honest. It's obviously a time of the year where you would normally have sort of GA inter-county season in full flow, and you know there would be a sort of a enthusiasm arising from that, perhaps. And yeah, like you had the FA Cup final yesterday, which was sort of a subdued enough affair in some respects, a different FA Cup final. But I don't know. There's not necessarily, the papers aren't full of mad sort of original reads today, I have to say. That's just personal opinion. I don't know what Kieran thinks, but I don't know. Maybe sometimes, I think even staffing wise, a lot of our Sunday papers, I think, are very reliant on GEA and their columnists, and maybe it's a bit more of a it's a bit more of a struggle at this time of the year. But I think, we're sometimes told that the Sunday papers have more time across the week than the dailies might have. It's sort of a tone that tends to be taken, but not necessarily overflowing with original stuff today. But maybe a lot of people are on holidays and stuff like that. That could be it.
Kieran, we do have some very interesting nuggets to look at, but I think is it fair to say in a more general sense across the papers today, very dominant FA Cup final fallout, understandably. GAA, GPA seems to feature very heavily across the papers today.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a slog, to be honest. Like, I go along with what Dan is saying. If I wasn't doing this review today, I don't know how much of this stuff I'd have read, to be honest. Like, I know it's the time of year, and it's, I was thinking this week, I should be in Tokyo this week for the Olympics and probably trying to watch a Donegal game in the Super 8s at some ungodly hour on GAA Go. And, everybody had an idea of how the year would pan out, and obviously it's been very different, but at the same time, and holidays kick in at this time of year, absolutely, as well. But I did find, often if you're bored writing something, the reader will be bored reading it. And I was bored with quite a lot of the stuff in the Sundays today. And just to contrast with the Saturdays, I know myself and Dan might be biased because we work for Daily, but I thought the Saturday papers were much stronger yesterday, and it's often the case. I know this is obviously a Sunday newspaper slot, but a lot of the Saturdays are effectively fill the role with dailies, the same role as a Sunday, because you have to come up with something original and, maybe something that hasn't really been covered in depth over the week, or something that hasn't been covered at all over the week. And I think the Saturdays have been doing that very well for quite a while. And today, other than the Sun, for example, it's Dan's beat. I haven't covered the League of Ireland in a long time, but there's hardly any League of Ireland coverage, and it started up again. It's four pages in the Sun. There's barely a mention in a lot of the papers. And, you have got what could be an incredible festival of European soccer coming up in both the Champions League and Europa League, and particularly the Champions League. Like, bar Liverpool, all the best club sides in the world nearly are there. So, and they're all going to be playing a series of games over a short period of time. And even at a World Cup or European Championship, you mightn't get that kind of quality because there'll be more cannon fodder in there. And I just didn't find that much stuff that was really interesting about it, bar Wayne Rooney's column.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Dan, when it comes to the League of Ireland, because I know on Thursday night's Off the Ball, you were mentioning how a focus is put onto the league now over the next few weeks, particularly because of the six-week break for the Premier League, and given the extra eyeballs that are potentially going to be on the product because of Watch LOI. Yet at the same time, there's not a huge amount of writing around the fixtures that have taken place so far this weekend.
Yeah, there never generally is in the Sundays, bar, as Kieran mentions, the Sun's coverage is always very strong. Now, in fairness, Mick Foley had a piece last Sunday, who was sort of laying out the foundations for what is a pretty interesting time for the league here. And I think there's sometimes a staffing element with this as much as anything. There isn't necessarily there's Sunday football writers, but obviously Paul Rowan's based in the UK and he's covered the FAI stuff so well and has an FAI piece today. But yeah, it's just one of the quirks, that I don't know, is it sort of editorial preferences or whatever it might be. I always would argue that the League of Ireland is an untapped resource for stories to some respect, because it's all about stories. All people want is original reads, and there's people in the league, and there's stuff going on at the moment, which I think is very interesting. Now, in fairness, like, you know, Sunday Indo have a couple of pieces today, Tommy Conlon and Eamon Sweeney, about their experiences of going to, well, in Tommy Conlon's case, their experience of going to a club game. But certainly, I would have thought personally, you know, there could have been a Sunday piece arising from maybe the closed doors experience on Friday for league games and stuff. But there's not necessarily people there to do that, and it's just a tone and a style. I mean, a lot of the Sunday stuff is column heavy in some titles. It's very, very reliant on their columnists, and you know, but just for whatever reason, like a couple of the columns today, it sort of feels like you know what the opinions are going to be at the start of it, and so at the end of it, you're not necessarily enlightened. And it's just one of those weeks, I guess. That's what happens. But I mean, yeah, like as I said, like the Sun of extensive coverage or stuff going on. Jack Byrne yesterday, you know, Stephen Kenny was there and so on. But yeah, John Sheridan, I was at that game, is sort of a bit of a story on John Sheridan stuff, and I'll be doing something on that for tomorrow. There's a bit of a colour around that. But yeah, I mean, maybe like there's a lot of reliance football wise on the FA Cup final, but I think in a strange way, one of the things about the closed doors thing, you know, like a lot of people would have watched the game, and it's hard maybe for even some of the titles covering it today to bring the colour of the occasion to a Sunday audience, because sometimes that colour might be something you spot in the maze, in the crowd, in the atmosphere, whatever it might be. It's slightly unusual. But yeah, it would have struck me like the League of Ireland had this big streaming experiment. We've had 2 days of it now. I know Owen Cowser referenced it in the Sun yesterday. I think there could have been something on that maybe somewhere, but it hasn't necessarily materialised anywhere. And it's listen, we're not being completely downbeat. There are some good pieces in the paper today, but and I am like hopelessly biased, but I think that, you know, the Saturday certainly in recent weeks, you know, have been thinking outside the box, and I don't think there's a huge amount of thinking outside the box in a lot of the Sundays today.
Kieran, we might actually start with that Tommy Conlon piece then. It is on the fifth page of the Sunday Independence sports section, and effectively it's like a diary piece for his experience. Went to the Limerick Club Championship games on Friday night just gone. I found a very different experience pulling into the LIT Gaelic grounds to normal, where you'd be trying to fight to get in through gates, and he was saying it felt like an empty Ennis Road when he was on his way in. And this has been the experience where crowds have been capped at 200 people for the last few weeks at sporting events in Ireland. And particularly when it's come to Gaelic games, it includes the backroom teams, the players. So really, it's about 50 people from each club. His story, though, I guess, has the wider implications across quite a few of the stories today, where potentially on the 10th of August, the government might actually up that number to 500.
Yeah, like I think in the Sunday Indo news section today, they have a leak from the government that that's going to be, I think it's going to be announced on Tuesday, that will go up to 500, because there's various pieces across the papers, you know, going into this lack of numbers. And, you know, Shane McGrath defends it, and I've been the Shane McGrath side of it, and others like Eamon Sweeney have been against it. And my issue with it, I kind of got weary of the special pleading for sports. You know, the why should sport be treated any differently? Like, a lot of people have really suffered through the pandemic, in a, not just in a medical sense, you know, people who've lost relatives, but the music industry has been devastated, and it's doubtful if it'll ever be able to recover. It's like small businesses, Dublin city centre, etc. And like the argument, like it's only a few weeks ago, really, since it seemed we would have no sport this year, and now it's getting up again, but there's still been a lot of complaining and whinging. And you know, the argument for sport coming back, the strong argument we made was the mental health aspect, that it helps people to play, the participation element. And that's back. So, no, that's where you get the serotonin rush. So now people want the crowds back in. But how do you control that? Like, you can say in the Gaelic grounds in Limerick, where Tommy was, you know, it holds 40,000, so 100 spectators are ludicrous. But you can't really distinguish between different grounds, I think. And then it gets complicated. Like, you could be a concert promoter and say, okay, why can't I put on a concert in the Phoenix Park and have 2,000 people there? You know, it's a massive place. You could easily spread 2,000 people. So I think you have to have blanket policies across the board, and there will be hard cases. But, you know, Tommy goes into the reality. Like, I haven't covered the League of Ireland in a long time, but the last couple of years it started going to Shelburne a lot, just because they're their local club, and a friend goes on a Friday and is way hooking up with them, you know, at the end of the week. Like, he would take his son off, his son would go off with his friends. And we'd just, you know, you'd be half watching the game and half just catching up. And, like, Tolka Park, compared to what it was, you know, it's a relic. Like, it's half of it is closed down. The sight lines aren't great. You know, it's a run-down stadium now. But I really loved it. Even, like, up to the last couple of games it was out, there were first division games. There was hardly anybody there. The quality wasn't great. And that strikes me about the whole streaming thing. To me, a large part of the League of Ireland experience, a huge part of it, is being there. Because we're so used to soccer on TV. You know, we have so many leagues out there. Like, we have to do something now because of the restrictions. But I think people do crave the personal experience of it again. And Tommy just, you know, gets into the practicalities of it. Like, it is, there is social distancing, there's hand sanitizers. Like, it's you're going to a game, but it's not like the experience that you're used to in any way.
Dan, did you find that, I mean, not from a GA sense, but covering the League of Ireland on this weekend, because I saw some of the pictures from Oriel Park and you saw that, like, whole rows had to be blocked off. Then there was one seat and maybe a whole load of block seats around that too. Even just being there in terms of covering a game from the press area, what was Oriel Park like on Friday night? Because normally that would have been hopping when Pats were playing St. Pat's on a Friday evening.
No, look, it's surreal. It's not the same. And I would have been in Tolka Park yesterday, and it's similar. And it's curious. I'm very torn on this. You know, I probably do. I'm more so on the side of probably Kieran and Shane McGrath ultimately when it comes to it. But in saying that, when you, like, you go to the games, I understand why it's jarring for people and why there's a commentary around it, because I think I saw someone earlier posting scenes of, was it Tato Park or something, or like you will see crowd shots of beaches or wherever it might be, and shopping centres where it's more congested, and then you go to the grounds and, like, yeah, you do find yourself, like, in Oriel Park, there's big spaces around behind the goals, and you're thinking, well, of course it would be safe if people were there. And but I mean unfortunately, like, a lot of what's happening with the virus here, it's about the messaging and the signal that you send. And yeah, like, it's almost like wearing a seatbelt, a lot of it. Oh yeah, you might be safe, but, and, like, going to the matches should be safe. And I think, yeah, you could let more people in, and I don't really have an issue with it going up to 500, because I think that's manageable. But it's not just purely about the actions of letting that many number of people into the game. It's about the messaging that goes with it. It's about the people have to travel to go together. It's, you know, it's, I appreciate why there probably has to be a blanket policy, like, because otherwise you just end up spending your whole time getting bogged down into technicalities. Like I know that the FAI at one stage were talking about the game with Finland coming up, and wondering, could you get 15,000, 16,000 people into the stadium? And a lot of that was even a discussion around, well, what about families going together? But again, like, how do you police that? Like, do you have someone with a census copy there to see the people sitting together? Like, it's not ideal. It's completely an unprecedented thing. But I do think, yeah, it just jars a bit to look for special permission for sport. Because I just think the optics on seeking it aren't great. While there's obviously like, you will look at the pictures of empty stadiums, and you will see people getting around it. Like, I know, I think, was there a county game in GAA in Donegal where there was loads of cars pulled up? And I know Finn Harps are very unhappy over that, because, you know, they could have, you know, they could easily fit a couple of hundred people on into separate entry and exit points of the ground and have no problem whatsoever. And, like, more often than not, like, people will be fine, but it's about setting the precedent. Being part of, like, unfortunately, like, we don't want sport to go away again. Like, this is, like, I think what we have now is unfortunately a best case scenario for a period of time. Our case count wouldn't be madly encouraging over the last week or so. And you don't want anything happening that is traced to sport in some way being responsible for anything, because you know people will seize upon it. And then we are in a situation where we have a very reactive, I think, governmental response to a lot of this. So whatever way the wind is blowing, they'll shut something down quickly. And unfortunately, what we have at the moment is a reasonably happy medium of sport is available. As Kieran says, the mental health aspect has been dealt with in that regard for the athletes. The streaming service that the League of Ireland introduced has actually gone quite well. And while it is a bit odd that you see pictures of 8 or 10 people congregating in a house to watch matches, they can't do it in the stadium, I sort of appreciate why they've gone that way, because getting into case by case, like, you know, and even one sport being treated differently to another, like, there's an element of the coverage again, and it's just the nature of it today that we have Tommy Conlon and Eamon Sweeney talking about, you know, the experience of the GAA fan and the GAA games, and, you know, Eamon talks about the Galway races and so on. But, and there's an element of the GAA as such an essential part of Irish life that naturally a lot of the coverage revolves around that. But, like, there has to be a consistency around that, that it's not just, that's all sports. It's rallies, it's whatever it might be. It's any of these events that bring out crowds. Like, there can't be an exceptionalism about one strand of it. It's rugby, it's everything. It has to be, like, horse racing meetings, it has to be all sporting gatherings of any description. So if you go down the route of making special permission, or, you know, going down the route of allowing permission for one, you sort of have to allow all. And are you fully prepared for that? Are all the facilities fully prepared for that? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, as Kieran mentioned, Shane McGrath, the chief sports writer in the Irish Mail on Sunday today, has brought up the crowds for the GAA, and the headline is "Restriction on Crowds: A Necessary Evil for the GAA." When it comes to this, Kieran, and I suppose taking Shane's argument into account here, it's probably not a great time for sporting bodies to be lobbying for games to be played. I know the Ladies Football Association have faced a lobby from two schools who are set to meet in the All-Ireland Schools Ladies Football Final. Clonmel are due to play against Moat, and similarly, we saw in the Shannon this week an argument being made for the Leinster Schools rugby final to be played between Newbridge and Clongowes Wood. At a time when the R rate has been raising, when we've seen more cases over the last couple of weeks, going back to kind of late May, early June levels, this isn't a particularly good time, whether it's John Horne going up to make an argument for the GAA or these schools teams. It's not a great time to be trying to argue to add in extra fixtures, is it?
I don't think so. Like, I think it was Vincent Martin at the Green Party that made that argument. And, it wasn't the forum for it. Like, it's something that really shouldn't be, put up at a national forum like that. But yeah, I understand his broader point. Like, that game means a massive amount to those involved, and they would have been working towards it for a long time, for a number of years, not just a number of months. But, you know, that's just something that you have to swallow. You know, this is the reality we're in. Like, you keep saying, like, we really did. I thought there'd be no sport this summer. Genuinely thought it would be wiped out. So I think we have to take what we've got now. And, you know, even I was talking to a doctor during the week, and she's pretty adamant that it's going to be a lockdown again in October. You know, like, I have no expertise in this. But she thinks the flu season is going to cause a huge problem. So I wouldn't be particularly confident that the GAA Championships will go ahead. So I think, you know, asking for more at the moment, I think we have to take it week on week. Mm. Because even over the last few days, the spike took a lot of people by surprise. So looking too far down the road is a mug's game. We really don't know where we'll be in a month's time, 2 months' time, 3 months' time. So, you know, I think just get on with it. Like, we're in a strange circumstance. And I think we just have to get, you know, take what we can get. You know, it did strike me, you know, when you look across the paper today, this would be the height of the GAA season. You would have, I think, the last weekend of the Super 8. You'd be building up to the hurling semi-finals or final. And it did illustrate to me how dependent the media are on inter-county games. Even though, you know, you had this whole club v county thing, that people are really weary of the debate. But if you look at the national media, the club stuff doesn't really impact. You know, I know RTE are showing some games, TG Carr, etc.
The scope is probably too wide, though, Kieran, for them to cover really at national level.
But I think, I know you've worked in local radio as well, Will. I think generally it's a more local radio, local paper thing, that it's harder for the Sunday Independent, Sunday Times, to focus in on a club game that will attract national attention. Mm. You know, when you get to later stages, finals or provincial championships, yeah. But at this stage, you know, it is a battle. And I think that's left a lot of GAA reporters scratching their heads a bit.
We have to take a break because we're heading towards the news at 2. We're going to pick up the conversation with football. We'll also talk about all the GPA coverage across the papers this weekend too. But the news is coming up at 2.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. Will O'Callaghan sitting in for Joe Molloy on this Sunday. We've got Dan McDonald from the Irish Independent and Kieran Cunningham, the chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star, joining us to take a look at all the stories in the Sunday papers. We were talking about Gaelic games and the restrictions on crowds and so on just before we went to the news at 2 o'clock. Kieran Cunningham, I very rudely cut across you, so I'll give you a first shot on all the GPA coverage that we've had. It's multiple across many of the papers today. You've got Sean McGoldrick's story, which I think is particularly interesting, that the GPA are hoping to try and renegotiate their deal with the GAA before the end of John Horne's tenure, which puts a serious clock on things. We were talking to Donal O'Neill, one of the co-founders of the GPA, during the week. His feeling was that the GPA has gone a little bit soft, that they've been stuck in a bit of a rut compromise-wise because of the deal that they cut with the GAA. And he feels that once financing came in from the GAA to the GPA, that effectively it was a better deal for the GAA because it offered them control. Now, the GPA are trying to renegotiate this. Is Paul Flynn being a bit optimistic and trying to get a deal with the GAA on terms of this agreement before the end of John Horne's term?
Well, I would think there's pressure on because the current deal is about to expire pretty soon, and also because of what COVID-19 is doing to the GAA's finances, or will do to the GAA's finances, is likely to leave a massive hole. So if they wait a year, it might be very, very hard to get anything like what they want or what they expect. So I think that there is pressure for them to do business as soon as they can. I'm sure I would say yourself and Dan agree, but it's kind of hard to plow your way through this GPA stuff because it's kind of been very repetitive. Like, the same things have been said about the GPA for years. Depending on who you're reading, you often know what they think because they've made it very clear their opinion either way. And a lot of it is opposition to the GPA. There is a lot of opposition, particularly among prominent columnists and amongst a certain of the journalists as well. And, you know, like Paul Flynn was very keen for people to stress the positive work they do, the amount of players they help and the programs they have for welfare and mental health, etc. And those numbers are out there. So I think they would have been keen to get those numbers out there. But there's quite a focus on salaries within the GPA, and, you know, the wages for the top senior executives is an average of nearly over €112,000 a year, and the average total bill for the six other employees is €293,000, an average of nearly €49,000 a year. You know, and it's right to highlight that and ask, is that value, are they paying over the odds? But at the same time, I think the same question should be asked of the GAA. The 14 top executives of the GAA earn an average of $125,000 a year each. You know, so, you know, if you're going to scrutinize one, you have to scrutinize them all. And I think as well, when you do focus on salaries, people living in Dublin, you need a quite decent salary to be able to live in Dublin properly. You know, if you have any ambition to buy a house or even to be rent a decent place, and a lot of places don't pay well enough. So perhaps the GPA paid a bit over the odds, but there's a hell of a lot of people in Dublin who pay way under the odds.
Yeah, I think Donal O'Neill made a very fair point when he was on speaking to Joe on Tuesday night just gone too, when they were talking about the GPA and the amount of money that flows through in terms of government funding and funding from the GAA. Around 70% of their income comes from the two sources. The point he was making was that the GPA will continue to require money at the levels that they're taking it from while the GAA continues to be a financial monster. So while the GAA continues to do deals with multinationals and they're bringing in big money in terms of their gate receipts and in terms of their commercial arrangements, understandably the GPA, as they represent the players, will try and take as much of a cut from that money as they possibly can, particularly given this is an amateur organisation.
It's easy to forget as well, Will, how necessary the GPA was. Because I remember for years, for 4 or 5 years before the GPA was founded 21 years ago, the amount of interviews you do with GAA players or read with GAA players or listen to with GAA players, they all brought up the same stuff. They all brought up how badly they were treated, the struggle to get basic mileage expenses from county boards. You know, you had stuff like county board officials would be going out checking cars after training to see if there were two or three players in the car, and they were all claiming for mileage, which would have been 10 cents a mile or something. You know, the struggle they had to get training gear or football boots or anything. So players were treated really badly for years, and there were a couple of attempts made to start up players' unions in the past, and they fell at the wayside very quickly. So Desi Farrell in particular is a pivotal figure in the history of the GAA because he stuck with it, took a lot of criticism for it, and put it on a solid founding. And I know some players who has helped greatly and fallen on hard times and has got them out of a hole. And a lot of the work they don't publicise because a lot of it is stuff that the players themselves wouldn't want publicised. So I think it's become very, very fashionable to bash them and think they're, you know, the great Satan. But I think the GPA is essential. But because of the GA model, you know, that it's got this kind of amateurism that isn't really amateurism. It's financed by a governing body, which is a very strange relationship for a players' union. And it's something you wouldn't get in other sports because obviously most other sports have a professional element. So it's facing into an interesting 10 years and the 10 years that it'll shape could be very different to the shape it's in now, I think.
Yeah, at the risk.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because it's my curiosity at coming at it from a sort of an external view to some degree as to what is the function of it supposed to be, you know, because I am, like, as I said, like the whole relationship of being under the wing to some degree and being reliant on funding support from, in theory, the association, the GAA that you're meant to be holding to account by representing your members. There's obviously a sort of an element of a conflict of interest there. And I appreciate there's probably all these welfare programs and so on. I'm probably more used in my parish to like the PFAI who are now they actually had an issue of perception because their offices are in the FAI, but probably shouldn't be really in all reality, but that was a practical thing. But like the optics of that aren't great. But they've had a situation in recent years where they've been in full on conflict with the FAI, where they've basically been barred from speaking to people. And that's not necessarily, I appreciate there's a professional element, but they were also very much involved with the women's football team dispute, some of whom would be, you know, amateur players effectively, and looking for issues of compensation around time off work and stuff like that. So like I read Colin O'Rourke's piece and he's talking about like, you know, GPA getting involved in sort of club fixture debates and stuff like that, which to me would strike me as maybe not what it's meant to be about, and that surely it is about the like why is it viewed as some kind of Satan, Kieran? Is it just because they might be, I saw some reference somewhere to like semi-professionalism and professionalism and this being like the view that the GPA might be trying to lead people towards that. Is that why there's a skepticism of them? Is that basically where it's born from?
That's largely it, Dan. Like it's seen as mercenary, it's seen as money grabbing. You know, people bring up they've done two fundraising gigs in America, fundraising dinners. They have this Super 11s hurling format they've taken to the States as a fundraising vehicle. And that's rattled a lot of cages, you know, both in terms of people saying, you know, this is money that should be going to the New York GA or the Boston GA, or that counties would be going over trying to raise their own money, and GPA have been there before them, or, you know, shaking the bucket around at the same time as them. So, a lot of people do see them as a Trojan horse, you know, that they're trying to usher in some form of professionalism. But, you know, some form of professionalism is there anyway, because all inter-county players get a government grant now. So even though it's a tiny payment for a lot of them, they are paid. You know, they're paid a sum, you know. And a lot of the people around inter-county teams are paid. There's quite a large staff in Croke Park that are paid, a lot of them are paid very well. So the GAA is, it's very hard to make sense of what the GAA is, because it's moved on from what it is in basically its mission statement. If you look at the mission statement, it's it conflicts with the reality now. Like, it's not really the amateur sports body that it claims to be anymore. So the GPA accept the reality of that, and they're pushing against the boundaries. Now, they've always stressed they don't want full-blown professionalism, but they do want to get as much for their members as they can.
Mm. It's not to overly simplify what's in the papers about the GPA today. You do have kind of two sides of the argument. You've Colm O'Rourke's piece in the Sunday Independent where he's arguing that the GPA now needs a culture of giving as opposed to taking. And as mentioned by Kieran, he's also arguing that maybe the GPA should be stronger on the club fixture story. Mick Foley, who's writing in the Sunday Times on page 12 today, has also looked at the negative perception of the GPA, where there's a lot of focus on the money that works through the coffers, but maybe not some of the programmes that they put in place, like educational grants, like training that they provide to some of their players. So both sides of the GPA shown there. Jumping towards football, Dan, you mentioned Paul Roan had a piece in the Sunday Times. It's on page 5 of the Sunday Times today, where he's writing about what's been happening in the FAI over the last little while. And to me, this seems to be very much framed as the FAI's old guard are now fighting back somewhat towards the new group that have come in.
Yeah, like the FAI story is still continuing. You know, it's continuing. We're well on over 18 months here now. If you take the Sunday Times 100 grand story as a start point in that, but even prior to that, a couple of months previously, there'd been stuff about governance and term limits and whatnot. And like it continues, and it hasn't gone away. Like it falls guilty to some of this, that like any story that's too heavily sort of acronym heavy, it's a bit like the GPA stuff, and you talk about GPA and CPA and like the FAI stuff. I mean, I'm doing a lot of days, you know, FAI and the memorandum of understanding, and you're referencing various reports and reforms, and like I think that it's actually a challenge to keep it fresh. Mm-hmm. And to keep it entertaining for people, because I can only just, you know, measure this by maybe engagement that I have with my own stuff that I've done around it, that like I think people are sort of following things now, but it's actually more of a committed group that are following it, and I think a lot of the general public are tuned out to some degree. You know, they want to know what's going to happen with John Delaney and so on, like a lot of the big picture stuff, but maybe some of the governance stuff that's going on at the moment is harder. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not important what's happening at the moment. Of course it is. There actually is, you know, there's some significant stuff happening. But I think maybe in some respects, a degree of the public disinterest reflects some of the problems that are being faced by a faction of people here. So you frame it there as like the old guard and the new guard. And again, I'm wary of getting bogged down into it. But basically what's happened is that there is a new FAI board, which is essentially the most powerful people on it now are people who are from the independent directorship area. These are people who have not been elected through football channels. They've been appointed through a process, however clear that process may be. And they are now really calling the shots in the FAI. And what we've seen in the last couple of months is an attempted fight back from people from the so-called old guard, or just to put it more simple terms, people who've been elected through football governance routes, you know, through various committees and the local FAs or whatever.
The phrase is the football family, Dan,
The football family, as it's being called. I mean, it was called the football family for years, except it was a family where just one person decided, you know, who got what at the family table. But now it's a family that it's meant to work together. But of course, it's horrendously dysfunctional because it was never a properly functioning family in the first place, because everyone just looked after themselves and didn't really worry about anyone else at the table. So what we have is a situation where there's a fight back, there's a move towards having half of the board made up of independent directors. And there was a view amongst people in the football community side of things that the new government might change things and decide that some of these old reforms that were being brought in were going too far, and that a new government would maybe resist some of these changes. But what's happened is the new government are basically saying, no, we're ploughing ahead with these changes, which will give a lot more control to independent directors and not the elected FAI appointees. That's all fine. You know, I can feel myself losing people already, because a lot of people are just like, you know, there is an element of, well, okay, what does this mean here? What's going on? But the what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is Mark McSharry, for example, in the Dáil, bringing the issue of the FAI's control to a national level again. And the viewpoint is now that are we giving over control of the FAI to outside interests, in inverted commas, completely? That will the FAI be run by people from outside the game. And this is supposed to, I think, energize people and enliven people. And there's people going to FIFA and UEFA and suggesting that Irish football is going to be this, like, this outlier compared to all of FIFA's like 200 plus member nations, that we're going to have these shadowy interests running the game compared to, well, you know, we could have the people elected through, our channels should have the greater say. That should always be the way. But the problem is, and I think from the public's perception, and I think that the government have backed this up, there's a view that, well, you've sort of had your chance. You didn't do a very good job. You know, for years, you know, there was a system there which proved that the system of bringing the FAI, like populating the FAI board with people coming through constituencies, it didn't work. And in reality, a lot of it has been interpreted as a last attempt by the old guard to preserve their positions rather than a broader debate on what we should do. Now, like someone said it, someone actually put it very well to me the other day I spoke to, who's involved in this, and they actually said that actually there are some of the correct questions are being asked about the new FAI at the moment, but they're being asked by the wrong people. And I sort of subscribe to that. I think there's valid questions about the process and how things have happened over the last 6 months, but it's very hard to take seriously the claims of people who have suddenly found their voice, having said nothing, absolutely nothing for 16 years, you know, and particularly the last 10 years when the FAI were sort of sleepwalking towards disaster. And some of the stuff that Mark McSharry, unfortunately, who's made headlines for other reasons, that he's come out with in the last couple of weeks, is rewriting history. It's completely rewriting history. He had something last week where he suggested that, like, former board members who ask questions are now being sidelined and can no longer serve in committees. Whatever about referencing old FAI council members who maybe weren't happy with the Delaney years, but they had their reservations privately and they weren't necessarily viewed as being a part of the regime. They still have to accept their, you know, their responsibility for not saying very much. But board members, the suggestion that there was these board members who were asking questions, like, that's just, I don't know who's briefing Mark McSharry, but they are presenting an alternative version of history that, by him putting it out there so strongly, is urging other people to look at it and go, well, this is just clearly the old guard trying to protect her position here, and it's completely clouded the whole debate. But
that's Mark McSharry, also been in the Dáil for quite a bit of the Delaney era. He's been a public representative.
He's been there for 18 years. Yeah. You know, like, he's there's pictures and look, there's been, you know, there's various activity. Like, there's a Noel Kennedy who's been active on social media, who's from the Sligo direction, who has been very active at the Sligo League. And I was looking through the archives, you know, would have been strongly involved 15, 16 years ago. When there would have been issues and discussions there. Go back a bit further, actually, about McSharry Park, ironically enough, which is related to Mark McSharry's father, Ray, and, you know, FAI political in that region. And you have people like Noel Kennedy coming out now on social media, who, like, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, an FAI AGM was standing up and saying that John Delaney was the best signing the FAI had ever made. And now they explain their approach to that year by saying, well, we represented the accounts every year at the AGM and we took the accounts on trust, as though there wasn't commentary and coverage around that time about the FAI finances that was completely ignored. Whereas now, all of a sudden, they are very, very interested in proper governance and procedures and this and that. But it must be said, there are other people involved in this who aren't necessarily from the old guard as such, who are saying that the method with which, you know, Gary Owens, Niall Quinn, Roy Barrett have come to the fore, you know, raises questions. They were previously linked last year in a group called the Visionary Group, who put out a pretty uninspiring document. And then the fact that they've all come together into positions of power, I understand that there's a scepticism around that and there's valid questions to be asked. But what I have to say is the concept of six independent directors being on a 12-person board, to me, it doesn't really frighten me, because they may be more independent as entities than, like, the language seems to be that it's 6v6, so that the six will want one thing and the other six will want the other. When surely, if you have a vibrant, properly functioning board, you'll have 12 people all operating together. But the language now is very much like it's going to be camps, because that's what we do. And, like, that is the old school FEI politics that needs to be taken out of the place. So there's a few things on. There's an emergency council meeting on Friday. I know the FEI are doing some stuff on Wednesday. The Paul Rowan piece today, actually, the detail of it explains how basically Roy Barrett and the new FEI board, the strong voices, have got government on side. They've got FIFA on side. They've got UEFA on side. There's a line from an unidentified board member there who basically says that they've been outflanked by the new people in charge of the FEI. And that seems to be a reflection of the fact that the old guard, they've tried to kick up over the last while, but I don't think they're going to have success.
Yeah. Kieran, I might bring you just a couple of pages further forward in the Sunday Times today. I didn't think I'd ever be saying this. Wayne Rooney is giving his prediction and his analysis of Real Madrid against Manchester City, the next leg of their round of 16 tie in the Champions League, where City have a 2-1 advantage, to be played this Friday night in Manchester ahead of this Champions League final tournament from the quarterfinals on. Very unusual end to the Champions League season, but we've got Wayne Rooney's quite interesting opinions on this.
Yeah, I think it's been mentioned here on a few different Sundays by different people that he's been an exceptional columnist. And I didn't think it was a huge surprise, because he did an interview with David Winner, I think, for ESPN, maybe, I can't remember how long ago it was, 10, 15 years ago. And the way he thinks about the game and the way he explains the game and the way he played his own game is really fascinating. And it's far more insightful than you often get from players. And, you know, he's carried that into the column, and whoever ghostwrited it as well, I presume it's ghostwritten. But there's a few little things that I wasn't actually aware of. You know, when you look at City, City are routinely talked up as possibly the best team in the world, or one of the best teams. And that I've always wondered, you know, but they lost 9 times in the Premier League. You know, keep being told it was a poor Premier League. How could the best team in the world lose 9 times? But Rooney points out they lost every other big six club, supposedly big six club, beat City last season. And Wolves beat them twice. You know, United beat them 3 times in various competitions. And there's something, and it'll be brought up this week, and it bugs Guardiola more than anything, is that he's never won the Champions League without having Lionel Messi in his team. And he did have an exceptional team at
Bayern Munich,
at Barcelona, obviously. But he went to Bayern Munich, and even, you know, domestically did really well. But, like, I think Bayern have now won, is it 8 in a row?
8 in a row after this season, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, more often than not, they're going to win anyway. So, but they fell short big time in Europe when he was there, as City have. Like, City, you know, they've yet to get to a final. I think they've been to one semi-final. So, for all the money that's been put into them, you know, they still have a lot to prove in terms of Champions League. I think what is interesting, what he said about how when Arsenal beat them in the FA Cup, when they beat City, he said, I noticed when City had a goal kick, Arsenal's midfielders went right up against De Bruyne and David Silva, almost man-to-man. And that was clever. It's the first time I've ever seen Ederson at a loss where to pass the ball. Against a team as difficult to control as City, probably the one time you could have an organised press is a goal kicks. And Arsenal exploited that opportunity well. And obviously Arsenal have Mikel Arteta, who was, you know, Guardiola's right-hand man as manager. And, you know, so I think there is a sense that some managers and teams have sussed them out a bit. And it will be fascinating to see whether that transfers to Europe, you know, whether they will be caught again in Europe. Like, Rooney still sums up that he thinks Atletico or City will win the Champions League. And City are favourites, which I'm still baffled by when you look at how often they've been beaten this season. But I'm really looking forward to these games, because the knockout phase of the Champions League generally throws up fascinating games and really high-quality games. And to have them all coming in such a short space of time could be special.
Yeah, Dan, I think we get an intriguing insight into Rooney the footballer and how he thinks about the game within his column this week too, because he talks about Manchester United knocking Barcelona out in the semi-finals the year before Pep Guardiola took charge, and the way that United deployed themselves that night en route to winning the Champions League. And then he talks about Ferguson's change in approach, where he was setting them out to attack and also leaving themselves wide open in the finals in 2009 and 2011. There's some very interesting little nuggets from Rooney tactically within this article.
Yeah, listen, what you want from a columnist, I mean, the whole function of a columnist and the reason that they, you know, they get paid well to do it is that they can give insight. You want to learn something. You want to take something from these pages and think, well, this gives me a better understanding of a situation, you know, what it's like to be on the pitch and involved in these games. And it's not just like a forced opinion or an easy headline or a sort of a generic sort of type of column where you sort of feel like this has been phoned in when he's on the golf course or something. The Rooney column is never that. And like there's actually, you can pick several aspects of it. Like as a result, he always generates a headline that's picked up elsewhere. And the story that's coming out of this is that he's been very critical of Alex Ferguson, actually, or been critical of Ferguson, not like over the top, and it's buried in the context of a piece, but I can see why it would be a headline taken elsewhere. Speaking about how in the Champions League finals where Manchester United played against Barcelona, that Ferguson got it tactically all wrong compared to 2008 semi-finals, when basically Manchester United swallowed their pride to some degree, as Rooney puts it, and they didn't use that term, but they had to basically cede possession, let Barcelona have possession and just deal with it and absorb it. And he tactically explains, you know, how to deal with the threat of Abidal and Iniesta on the left side, and that would have been part of his brief. And he goes into great detail about how between himself and Michael Carrick and Paul Scholes and Park Ji-sung, they did actually a lot of the running that day, and it was the defenders who didn't. And they kept the shape. But I think he speaks, was it the Champions League final in, I'm not sure if he specifies which Champions League final it is, because they obviously lost 2 to Barcelona. But he has a specific line that he remembers Alex Ferguson saying, "We're Man United and we're going to attack. It's in the culture of this football club." And Rooney says he was in the dressing room thinking, "I'm not too sure about this. I think all the players knew deep down it was the wrong approach, that we were abandoning the way that it brought success in that 2008 semi-final. And sure enough, both times we got outplayed. There was being true to the club, but then they're sitting back afterwards and thinking, we've lost. For me, it doesn't matter how you do it in these big Champions League games, as long as you win." And it is actually unusual to see a very open criticism of Ferguson's tactics. I don't recall too many instances of that, and you could correct me on it, that a lot of the Fergie stuff that's come out is like the dealing with Keane and Stam and various people, how he discarded them and personality clashes. And I know his relationship with Rooney maybe, you know, was not great, particularly towards the end. But he sort of says, listen, that Ferguson had a suicidal approach to these finals against Barcelona, and it cost them. And that, to me, is good value from a columnist. Yeah. And that's something that many years on, we're getting something from it.
I wonder if Fergie maybe mellowed in the decade after his arguments with both Stam and Keane, because I think he said of 2011, it was a couple of years later, that he had approached things wrong, particularly at Wembley, that United hadn't learned the tactical lessons from Rome. I kind of took from what Rooney wrote that the go out and attack, we're Manchester United, we're going to do our own thing, that was probably ahead of the game at the Stadio Olimpico as opposed to Wembley. But then Ferguson left them short in midfield a couple of years later in 2011. And again, they were perhaps even taken apart a bit more comprehensively in that one. It's interesting as well, Kieran, we look at Man City's defence ahead of this game against Real Madrid. Now, Madrid didn't score a huge amount of goals in La Liga this season. Sergio Ramos was their top scorer outside Karim Benzema, and he outscored pretty much the entire rest of the squad with 10 league goals this year. When we look at Man City's defence, there's a graphic inside this Rooney piece where City have had huge problems conceding goals in the Premier League against the top six, and pointed out in this graphic too is that teams outside the top six, against Wolves they conceded 5 goals in their 2 Premier League games this year, and they also conceded 4 against Manchester United and Arsenal in 3 games in the cup competitions, and they were conceding less than a goal a game against the top six the year before. It's quite clear that City have defensive problems this season.
Without a doubt. Like a lot of it was put down to Laporte, Aymeric Laporte had been missing. But even when he came back, I think there were still issues there. You know, like I know Vincent Kompany was injured on and off for the last few years, seasons that he was there. But he made such a difference when he was there. And I don't think City have anything like him anymore, even though Laporte, you know, can look like a top-class player. You know, I always feel like both full-backs can be got at as well. And even though he's a brilliant distributor of the ball, Ederson has mistakes in him too. You know, City often look brilliant. Like, they often look sensational, but they're the team, like, if they get 2-0 up after 20 minutes, what they often do, they end up winning 4 or 5-0. You know, their opponents roll over. But when they're in a battle, I'm not so sure about them. You know, I'm really not. Like they hammered Liverpool in a game, you know, when Liverpool had zoned out. When it really mattered in big games against Liverpool the last few years, they really fell well short. And, you know, this is a massive, you know, it's obviously it's a massive game for them, but I think it's a massive game for the future of the club now, because, you know, there comes a time they really have to do it in Europe, and Guardiola has to do it with City in Europe. He's not going to be out the door if they fall short. But if they go out to this stage, if they go out fairly limply after losing 9 times in the Premier League, you're finishing your season with a League Cup. And when you've spent as much money as City have, you know, that's failure. That's big time failure.
Yeah, they have a very difficult side to draw if they do progress against Real Madrid, which was a hard tie in the round of 16. It's sometimes why I wonder about the favouritism in the bookmakers. They've got Bayern Munich, Barcelona, Napoli, all on that side of the draw too. I think I'd much prefer to be on the PSG, Atalanta and Atletico Madrid side of the draw. And Man City, if they do win this Champions League, will certainly have to earn it. Dan, I was just thinking before we head towards the break, back at the Sunday Mirror today is a serialisation of Troy Parrott's interview, which he conducted when he joined Millwall yesterday. Very much following in the footsteps of Harry Kane, Dan. Paul O'Hare's got a piece in the Sunday Mirror about it. You know, previously, Harry Kane, on some of his many loans before he became the very impressive striker he is now, went out to Millwall. We had Jason Malumbi at Millwall last season. He was giving Parrott advice about going there for next season. Is the Den a good location for Troy Parrott to go?
No, I think it is. I think it's perfectly, you know, it's the perfect move for him at this stage. I think, you know, he was obviously linked with loans even in January, and I think I got the sense at that stage, I mean, Spurs, I don't think we're massively keen on it, and I think they're quite protective of Parrott. I think it suits them that it's London as well, rather than sending him off somewhere as such. I think there's an element that he just needs to maybe mature in a couple of areas, but there's no doubt in that his football ability is top notch, but he needs to get on that ladder. I mean, you know, if you were talking about Ireland games in September, which we are, they're creeping up around the corner. You know, you can see why, say, Stephen Kenny, who I don't think he's going to pitch in too many young lads, by the way, but I can see why he would have more reason at the moment to trust Aaron Connolly or Adam Ida, even based on the club experience they're getting. And the reason Parrott hasn't got those minutes is he's at a better club than those. I've no doubt if he was at Brighton or Norwich, you know, he would have got minutes, more minutes this year. But I don't think Jose is going to be at Spurs this time next year, personally. But it's no harm for Troy to go to Millwall for a year and learn. I mean, the Parrott comparison is easy. Or sorry, the Kane comparison is an easy one to make, I guess. But there is something in it. I think there's similar representation in terms of, you know, the agency side of things. And, you know, they know the route. And at this stage, the fact that, like, Millwall nearly got promoted or nearly got into the playoffs this year, and the excitement that's around them, like, that's what strikes me. Sometimes we're very guilty about getting too excited about our own players here, and it's not necessarily reflected across the water. But I even was over doing some stuff around Parrott last year. Like, he actually is a name in England. Like, there's a lot of expectation around Troy Parrott. And Millwall, the fanfare that there was for an 18-year-old signing on loan, compared to what there would have been when Harry Kane went there and people back in the day. Like, he's got expectation on his shoulders here. But also as well, he might not necessarily have crowds at the start. So there's almost that perfect opportunity to go in there to some degree and show what he can do. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's an occupational hazard in OTB Towers that Richie McCormack particularly puts on the Europa Youth League midweek during the season. So we've had to watch a lot of Troy Parrott over the last 18 months. And Kieran, he's looked very impressive when he goes up against players of his own age level, and even he's been good for Spurs under 23s. But crucially, this move to Millwall means he's going to be playing against men for the next 12 months. And we're probably going to learn an awful lot about Troy Parrott in this period.
Yeah, no, I think it'll... I wouldn't say the making or breaking of him. Like, I wouldn't go that far; it'd be ridiculous. But I think it's an important part of his development. Like, loan moves are very much part of the game now. Like, particularly if you're at a big club, you generally will have a couple. You'll have a couple as part of your CV over the years. And it's important to remember he's only 18. Like, if you look at the on loan strikers who've made an impact in the Championship the last couple of years, Rhian Brewster, go for Liverpool to Swansea. Excuse me. Scored 11 goals, I think, in 22 games. Did really well. But, he's 20. Tammy Abraham last season was 21, scored 23 goals for Derby County and one for Chelsea. So, they've been sent out on loan from big clubs at a couple of years, at a time when they're a couple of years older than Troy Parrott. So, it shows... I think Troy Parrott will score goals in the Championship. I think it'll suit him. I don't think he's... much chance of getting into the Tottenham team anytime soon. So it's an ideal move for him. But really, it's down to himself. Because if you look at the Harry Kane thing, I remember talking to David Ford about it. David Ford was a Millwall goalkeeper at the time. And he would beg David Ford to stay on after training. And he would he put in endless hours of shooting practice on his own with David. You know, so he was very, very keen to make the loan work and put in the extra work. And Troy Parrott has to do that. Like, to make it as a top Premier League player, you have to work harder than everybody else who wants to make.
Okay, we're going to take a very short break here on Off the Ball this Sunday. When we come back, we're going to be talking about two of the most interesting articles I think of this weekend. We'll be talking snooker and also looking forward to the PGA Championship and the transformation of Bryson DeChambeau.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome back to our Sunday paper review here on Off the Ball. If you've missed any of our chat with Kieran Cunningham and Dan McDonald, you can get the podcast on otbsports.com, or you can also check out the new OTB Sports app, where you can get all of the listen back options there. It is available in your app store now. Gentlemen, moving forward towards the golf, because we've got Memphis on currently, WGC St. Jude Invitational, which is the warm-up event ahead of Harding Park in San Francisco next week, what turns out to be the first major of the year, the behind-closed-doors PGA Championship. But Bryson DeChambeau, over the last few weeks, has captured the imagination a little bit, no less so because of the transformation, both in terms of his size with the muscle that he's packed on during lockdown, but also the extra clubhead speed and the distance he's been getting off the tee. Dan McDonald, he has become an interesting subject for Derek Lawrenson's piece, which is in the mail this afternoon. He's called The Mad Scientist, and the headline here is, "Can Bryson the Mad Scientist really eclipse the artist of golf?"
Yeah, so we have the USPGA coming up next week, so we have a major back, and Dermot Gillies has a preview too, and there's various bits and bobs across the papers, actually. Dennis Walsh has something about the Irish Open's future as well, which is, you know, potentially in doubt for 2020. So there's a bits and bobs in that across the pages. But certainly Bryson DeChambeau has probably been one of the main talking points. Has been keeping the Golf Weekly lads busy over the last while. And you know, his eye-opening expansion, shall we say, which has led to a fair amount of conjecture and I think interesting talking points, not least from Brooks Koepka, who has stirred it up and almost sort of, you know, it's very rare you talk about, like, you know, the tension around golf actually being interesting. You know, generally it's all very, you know, everyone tried their best and they're all great guys really, and aren't they all very sportsmanlike and so on. But actually there's you know, golfers by their very nature are sort of selfish and self-obsessed, like, you know, a lot of the better ones, they have to be. And there's actually a sort of a dislike there between I think Koepka and Bryson in particular. It's actually kind of it's kind of interesting. Like, Bryson is very hard to warm to, but there's no doubt that he's interesting. Like, I see he even said last week that he's planning to live until he's 130 or 140 years of age, because he thinks that's possible with today's technology. So, I mean, we may not be around to see if he lives out that prediction, but he's clearly thinking outside the box, certainly in his thinking. He's had this issue in recent weeks where he doesn't actually like the intrusion of the cameras, And he takes on the rules officials publicly. Like he's had, I think Lawrenson mentions that on Thursday at the FedEx International, he argued for a free drop because fire ants were within the vicinity of his ball. Now, like, golf is supposed to be about the great honour of, like, you call your foul. Anytime someone calls their ball moving, they're, like, hailed as a heroic figure. Whereas Bryson is more so, it's almost like he's calling for VAR all the time in terms of what's going on. And I think Koepka was actually playing yesterday and made this joke about, I think there might be an ant on my ball.
Yeah, he said to his caddy, I think there's an ant. And then his caddy goes, seriously, he goes, I'm joking.
He can't help himself. But I have to admit, like, you know, it's sort of hearing all of this and seeing this is possibly more absorbing a sporting spectacle than every shot having someone shouting mashed potato or something, you know? I'm actually really looking forward to the USPGA. And I know golf isn't everyone's thing. I'm not sure if Kieran's a big golf fan, but I'm actually interested. But, I mean, yeah, like there's a lot in this piece just about how he's... you know, he talks about how he wants to make the old golf courses obsolete. He's talking about the 13th, which is one of the classic holes in Amen Corner at Augusta, and he has this new plan now that's going to smash the ball onto the 14th fairway. And like the traditionalists are horrified by this, and he's very hard to warm to, but he's sort of interesting. And I must admit, you know, I don't particularly like him. I actually think that there's still, you know, valid points to be raised and not to be sort of flippant about the sudden expansion and you know, the dominance and you know, there's a lot in that. But I suppose you need more to go to it than just speculating. But there's certainly a lot in that. But at the same time, you sort of find yourself turning him on when he's on the telly. And that's probably not a bad thing in terms of drawing people into it.
Yeah, it could have been wonderfully uncomfortable if Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau had to be on the same Ryder Cup team if Whistling Straits had been going ahead in September. We get a graphic to illustrate maybe how the game has changed. And I think if you want to have a listen back and maybe to get a bit of an insight into Bryson DeChambeau when he was breaking through as a professional player, stick within this house in many ways. Golf Weekly, I think it was 3 weeks ago, they had Padraig Harrington on for a couple of hours, and they asked Padraig Harrington, who felt that Brooks Koepka was being very unfair by throwing particularly pointed tweets out there without actually making the point himself. And Harrington was to Bryson DeChambeau's defence by saying that when he was an amateur player and just about to get his pro card, he had been out in the driving range with him at a small tour event, and he saw that Bryson DeChambeau had all of that power inside of his body. He had a lot of club speed, but because he was focusing on accuracy when he was getting his PGA Tour card, he maybe wasn't quite pushing himself to his potential, which he's now doing. But a remarkable swing off the tee from at the moment. His longest drive of this year, 428 yards. Now, it's eclipsed by Tiger Woods when Tiger at the turn of the century was hitting nearly 500 yards. But that swing speed is up there past Tiger at 137 miles per hour. He's getting a ball speed of over 200 miles per hour. And given that he's now 17 stone 2 and 6 foot 1, Bryson DeChambeau has got probably one of the top 10 drives across the entire PGA Tour. And it's a huge weapon for him to take into next week. Is it something, Kieran, you look forward to next week, the PGA Championship, given that now, for us golf fans, it's been a long time to wait to actually have a major this year, given that the Open was lost and that the Masters was pushed back into the autumn?
Yeah, no, I think people will really savor that, because, you know, even you know, the casual golf fans who might tune in every week, you know, do tend to watch the majors, and particularly because the other majors been sidelined. I think that's and because of the Bryson thing, I think people are curious about this guy, and you know, his record at majors isn't great, but you know, the furore over it around it reminds me of a guy called Charles Hughes. I'm sure Dan heard the name of him, but he was a director of coaching with the English FA in the 80s, and he came up with this thing called POMO, which was position of maximum opportunity, and was basically getting the ball forward as far and as quickly as possible. So it was, you know, it was kind of the philosophy behind the long ball game that became popular with Watford and Wimbledon and other, and Ireland to an extent, mm-hmm. the late 80s and early 90s. But the traditionalists and the purists hated it and, you know, thought it was so crude. And there is a reflection of that now in the reaction to Bryson, because basically it is a similar thing, to get the ball as near to the flag as quickly as possible. And, you know, it is working. And, you know, there is an interesting story Derek Lawrenson tells about what his personality going back to when he was a kid and when he was 13 and he was asked to tidy his bedroom. And as Derek Lawrenson points out, you know, generally such conversations with 13-year-olds go one way. But his dad, John, takes up the story. He said, Bryson grabbed them off the broom brush and the vacuum cleaner, he told the Bleacher Report. He got hold of the pledge to polish the doors and the 409, a cleaning agent. 3 hours it took him. When he finished, it was crazy spotless. So he has this drive and this obsessive streak to him. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the daily gym sessions, 2,000-calorie breakfasts, the power and the muscle he's put on, he says, I want to make the old courses obsolete. You know, there's an arrogance there. And, you know, a lot of people will want him to fall flat in his face, but be interested to see how it pans out.
Yeah, Harrington was also arguing when he was talking to the guys on Golf Weekly. He thinks that maybe DeChambeau is creating a little bit of a brand around himself, this idea of the amount of weights he's doing, what he's eating, making himself out to be a little bit special, perhaps, to make himself a bit more entertaining. Also, if you do want to read some more of the previews, and as mentioned by Dan, Dermot Galise has got a fairly extensive preview of the PGA Championship. There's even a hole-by-hole breakdown of Harding Park there, and there is an article there by Ewan Murray too, who's been talking about the amount of first-time major winners that we've had in the last while, and Rory McIlroy's long wait to try and get his fifth major title, which could happen next week, but I don't think it will on the back of the way he's been playing at the St. Jude Invitational this week. Of course, that final round getting underway in a couple of hours' time. Dan, we've got the snooker as well. We were talking to Shane Hannan a bit earlier on the news round, who's our resident snooker expert here in the Off the Ball office, but unfortunately, Ken Doherty came close enough to qualifying. Fergal O'Brien didn't qualify either. No Irish representation at the World Snooker Championship. I think for a lot of people who were probably interested in snooker here in Ireland, in all likelihood, they remember Ken Doherty in 1997.
Yeah, I mean, or even, you know, you go back to Dennis Taylor, you know, and sort of being one of those characters that you would have grown up as sort of been a big sporting personality of the 80s, obviously. And yeah, you probably were used to, like, even I know I watched Fergal O'Brien in the qualifier the other day. He was a late night one against Liang Wenbo, and there was more disputes around fouls and whatnot and that too. But yeah, Mark Gallagher has a piece in the Mail on Sunday today, and I think I found it one of the more enjoyable pieces today, just because it's different. And again, like, it's almost like our chat at the start, that there's almost like a lot of focus on sort of the set piece stuff and the columnists and so on. But I just like that Mark generally always finds something away from the big three sports often. And you know, take something that's ongoing at the moment and presents an angle that's, you know, makes you think, and that's probably what a classic Sunday piece should be. And yeah, he's looked into the Irish snooker scene at the moment to see what's actually going on. He references, you know, the snooker boom of the sort of 80s and 90s, where there was so many snooker clubs in Dublin you couldn't get a table. And now, you know, I think he makes a point. He is speaking to someone who's involved in the scene, because I think he went out to Cross Guns on Tuesday, one of the older snooker clubs, and saying you can count on both hands now the number of places where you can play the game. There must be no more than six or seven, which is very different to the norm that used to be. But it does seem to be some hope that there's two young kids from Cork coming through. At the moment, Aaron Hill and Ross Bullman, who were in the early qualifiers, they're both 18 years of age. And obviously snooker, I mean, Ken Doherty's still going a good sort of 30 plus years on from that. So, you know, there's no time limit on these guys. But there seems to be a view that maybe there's some good players coming through. But for whatever reason, snooker's changed. There's a lot of Chinese players and there's a few Thai players coming through. And maybe, you know, despite that popularity and success that we had, I mean, did our social habits change? Like, you wonder what it was that moved things away dramatically. But it looks like we have a couple coming through now. But it's just a good piece just to get an appreciation of the scene and the situation that's there at the moment, just to see what's actually happening. Because it is unusual, I guess, or disappointing to have it's a very sport, a British and Irish orientated sport, perhaps, and we have no representation in the World Championships.
Yeah, and the point made here, Kieran, and it happens with so many sports, is that it's been made that these young people are here, they're trying to kind of scrape a living on the tour. In the case of Aaron Hill, he's got a wild card. He's at the moment able to play a limited amount of tournaments. It's not going to sustain him full-time, his work. And that realistically, if these guys are going to make their way over to England and to make an impression on tour, they're probably going to need financial backing to try and do so.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the one of the most interesting elements to Mark's piece is, you know, it impacts that what happened to snooker. Like, why has snooker fallen away? And I remember when there used to be snooker halls all over Dublin, and basically it was a Celtic Tiger that killed it. Because, you know, I talked to Ken Doherty about this a few years ago. I just took out with Ken saying, he says, if you 12 snooker tables, there's a lot of space. If you rented that as office space, you'd probably get three times as much money. And Ken also pointed out to me that attention spans is part of it. Because if you've got PlayStations and iPhones and Xboxes, the thing about snooker, it needs endless practice. You know, you need to put in hours and hours of practice every day on your own, and it can be quite boring. And a lot of kids don't have that kind of attention span now. And, you know, I was thinking about this morning. Like, I worked as a barman in the Stag's Head pub in Dublin for 4 years. And there was a snooker hall, it's just off Dane Street. There was a snooker hall down the road. And it was only known as Johnny's. It didn't have any sign, but it was a massive. It was over three floors. There were a huge amount of space there. And Johnny used to come in, like, as far as I could see, he survived on a toasted beef sandwich and Jameson whiskey and nothing else. I never saw him eat or drink anything else. But he was there for a long time. And you go into that snooker hall, and even now in the early 90s, it was empty a lot of the time. There'd be one or two of the tables taken up. And now it's been turned into Four Dame Lane, which is, you know, a kind of a super pub there that a lot of people would be familiar with. So a lot of snooker places like that was prime location. It was a massive building in Dublin, 2-3 minutes walk from Grafton Street. So to have that, it's very difficult for that to survive as a snooker hall when you have that prime real estate in such a prime location. And like Ken told me what it used to be like. Ken told me, like, he would finish school at 13, 14. He would get the number 15 bus into town, to places like the Cosmo on, I think it was Dorset Street or O'Connell Street. And he was hustling. Like, he would say to the guys there, I'll give you a £25 start. And really, he should have said, I'll give you a 50 start or a 60 start. They didn't realize how good he was. And he got a five or a tenner here. And like, that was his pocket money. He did. And that whole world that Ken grew up in.
Changing times. Kieran, I'll have to leave you there. Many thanks to Kieran Cunningham and also to Dan McDonald for joining us on our paper review. If you missed us, you can catch us on the pod. We're going to be talking Olympics and Paralympics when we come back after the news headlines at 3.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.